Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is the age of impunity. With me to discuss how the international community can hold accountable governments and terrorist groups that kill or brutalize civilians is David Miliband. David is president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee, a global humanitarian charity founded by Albert Einstein in the 1930s. It seeks to help people facing the world's worst humanitarian crises survive and rebuild their lives. David oversees some 20,000 staff at 200 field sites that run IRCs, humanitarian relief operations in more than 40 countries. A child of refugees himself, he had a distinguished career in Britain's Labour Party and served for 3 years as the United Kingdom's Foreign Secretary, or more formally, Secretary of State for Foreign and Commonwealth Affairs. David, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jim. As a longtime listener, it's nice to be a talker on your show.
Well, I'm very glad that you accepted the invitation and to have you here today. We're supposed to talk about impunity, which the dictionary tells me is exemption from punishment or freedom from the injurious consequences of an action. Now, you have written and spoken quite widely that you believe we are currently in an era of impunity. What do you mean by that?
So I'm making three claims in this argument. Claim one is that over the last 15 years, we've seen the rise of impunity in conflict zones around the world. In this context, impunity means crimes without punishment, not just decisions without checks and balances, but crimes without punishment. 37,000 civilians, 70% of the total number killed in war last year, were civilians. 2.5 times as many civilian fatalities as in the previous five-year period, nearly 10 times as many as in the period 2005 to 2009. This really came home to me when two of our International Rescue Committee staff operating an ambulance in northwest Syria were killed when their ambulance was targeted from the air. So claim one is that there's been a marked rise in abuse of international law and international humanitarian law in conflict zones around the world. Claim two is that this age of impunity in the international sector is the counterpart, the international counterpart, of something that you've talked about a lot on your show, the democratic recession at home. In part, the age of impunity in war zones around the world reflects the retreat of democracy within the democratic world, the rise in power, economic and political, of autocratic countries. So the second claim is that we've got something distinctive here at the international level in the breaches of the rule of law. And it was interesting to me that when the US intelligence community just published its global trends from now to 2040, it highlighted the weakening of the rule of law as a serious risk. And my argument is that what's happening in conflict zones, where the rights of civilians to life could not be clearer in international law, and the abuses of those rights could not be clearer, are the tip of the iceberg. They're especially important because the rights are clear and they're being abused systematically. The third claim I make is that this impunity reflects shifts in the balance of power. And if one wants to push back against impunity, we need to borrow a phrase of John Kenneth Galbraith, we need to borrow and build countervailing power. Impunity represents the exercise of a power without accountability, what former British Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin, you'll remember, he said that power without responsibility is the refuge of the harlot throughout the ages. My argument is that if you want to push back against impunity, then we need to build countervailing power. Galbraith used it in connection with pushing back against the overweening power of big US corporates after the Second World War. My argument is we have to build at the international level governmental power, civil society power, private sector power to push back against this impunity, because it is ruinous for hundreds of thousands of people who are trapped in conflict around the world at the moment. But it's also got wider significance. Once the law becomes for suckers, then it's very hard to retain the essentials of a civilized society. So that's the argument I'm making.
Well, let's take the argument piece by piece, David, if you may. Let's begin with your first point, that we've seen an increase in impunity in conflict zones. And I note, in sort of reading what you have written on this topic over the years, you have in the back of your head a period after the end of the Cold War where we seem to be making progress in just the opposite direction, trying to hold governments and terrorists responsible or accountable for their actions. So you could sort of give us that background that you see the international community is sort of retreating from over the last decade or so.
Yeah, that's a really important point. Now, to state the obvious, there's never been a golden age. The rights of civilians in war may have been proclaimed after 1945, rights of individuals that would sit alongside the rights of states. And obviously, during the Cold War, those rights were in many places not adhered to. They were clear, but they weren't adhered to. The post-Cold War period, the 1990s, they were actually murderous in various ways. The word Srebrenica is known, the place Srebrenica is known for, appalling murder of 8,000 people. The genocide in Rwanda as well. But it shocked the world into action. And there was a brief period, really, between the mid-90s and the mid-2000s, when issues of responsibility in international affairs, when commitments of state actors to international treaties, when the responsibilities of the international community when nation states fell back were taken seriously. That led in 2005 to something called the Responsibility to Protect Resolution. It was a resolution of the United Nations signed by all 193 countries of the UN. And it said that when states did not defend the rights of civilians, then it was the job of the international system to do so, to make sure that the rights that existed on paper existed in reality. And my argument is that those high hopes, which found some form in diplomatic, political, economic, but also military interventions in Kosovo, in Sierra Leone, we've seen since 2005-06, just as there's been democratic recession at home, there's been increasing abuse of international law abroad, and we can discuss why that's happened. But the story I'm telling is that we don't need to invent new rights. We need to make sure that the rights that were adumbrated after the Second World War fully get implemented.
David, I want to get into the diagnosis in a moment, but maybe you can lay out for us what conflicts you currently see where impunity is operating, that civilians are being brutalized or killed, and the perpetrators are not being held accountable.
Yeah, thanks for giving me the chance to do that, because it's very much in my mind. Syria is a prime example where state and non-state actors are holding civilians to ransom and abusing their rights on a massive scale. Yemen, where the most unspeakable crime was 43 children killed in a Saudi-led coalition bombing raid on a coach in northern Yemen. Ethiopia, where you have state actors, but also non-state actors, 350,000 people facing famine now, but a wider range of people, up to 4.5 million, in desperate humanitarian need as aid is prevented from reaching them, and a range of other breaches of international humanitarian law. I'm also very concerned about the situation in Afghanistan.
I think you're right to be.
Yeah, 1,100 International Rescue Committee staff, 98% of them Afghans, who are extremely concerned about, to put it mildly, about the prospects for the country and the ability of the system to hold. Now, in the recent past, I would have also put onto the agenda the ethnic cleansing that happened in Myanmar and drove 850,000 people into neighboring Bangladesh. That would undoubtedly have been high on the list. But those are some of the examples. South Sudan, I could give you another example, one of the probably the world's newest nation, country of 12 million people, now 2 million refugees. Very serious war crimes that have taken place there. So those are the kind of places that give human form, both in the clients that we in the International Rescue Committee serve and the staff who we try to protect, give human form to this syndrome that I'm describing.
So let's talk about why we're seeing new rise of impunity, David. Again, if you were to go back 16 years, responsibility to protect, R2P is passed. Everyone is thinking this is a major turn in world history. We're going to finally see the values enshrined in things like the UN Charter translated into public policy. There's going to be consequences. Clearly, that's not happening. You attribute it to the democratic recession or being linked to the democratic recession and changes in geopolitics. Sort of walk us through what happened.
I think there's three or four things, really. I mean, first of all, the experience in Iraq and Afghanistan of Western nations has not just drained support for international engagement in Western democracies. It's also shown how many of the tools that exist aren't good enough for holding power to account in an effective way. Obviously, the US is not a part of the International Criminal Court, but neither was Syria, country of Syria, interestingly enough. But the tools are not adequate to the job. And the failings that have happened in foreign policy in the last 20 years from the Western side undoubtedly contribute to that. I think the second thing that's very important is the shift in the balance of economic power in the global system. It is very, very striking that 2019 was the first year in 100 years when the cumulative GDP of the world's autocracies was greater than the cumulative GDP of the Western democracies. It's a crude measure, but it's a good measure of shifting economic power. And that's undoubtedly part of the story, not least because the leading autocratic power, China, places such value on non-interference in internal affairs. And we are talking about war crimes within intrastate wars, within civil wars, not in the main in wars between states. And so the second thing is that the shift in the balance of power, I think, globally has impacted. Thirdly, there's no question that the ideological shift within the West to emphasize sovereignty over international rights has contributed to the reinforcement of the argument that is put every day by Chinese and Russian diplomats at the United Nations down the road from where I am, that governments should be allowed to do what they like within their own territories. There's been an advance of that argument in this country. President Trump devoted his speeches to the UN to telling his audience why it was nations that counted, not international bodies. We won't talk about Brexit on this occasion, but that's obviously part of the story as well. I think there's a fourth element, which I just want to dwell on for a moment, which is the changing nature of conflict today. There aren't hot wars between states, but there are civil or uncivil wars within states. And it's very interesting, if you look at, there's a famous saying that the most likely product of a civil war is for the restart of that civil war. These wars are long-standing. And they're also internationalized. The Uppsala database shows that the extent of internationalized intrastate conflict has grown about fivefold in the last 15 or 20 years. And it's not unusual to have 5, 10, 15 different countries supporting different proxy forces in different conflicts around the world. And in those conflicts, by their nature, the urban terrain is the battlefield. And when urban terrain is the battlefield, civilians are caught in the middle. And you can see that in Yemen, you can see that in Syria, you can see that in Afghanistan. And so I think there is something here about the changing nature of conflict that has contributed to this age of impunity. Obviously, non-state actors aren't bound by international treaties, but they've dragged down, they've lowered the bar and given excuses to states who don't want to abide by them.
David, before we turn to the question of what to do about impunity, are there any bright spots on the scene that you see? Are there governments or international agencies that you see doing what they should be doing to protect these rights?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting example. Obviously, if we'd been holding this conversation 2 years ago, one would have pointed to the Nobel Peace Prize for the new prime minister in Ethiopia as very significant because the peace with Eritrea was so significant. One wouldn't point in that direction now. I think the truth is that I'm warning about an age of impunity because there aren't many bright spots. But I think if one wants to look for them, I look to civil society. And a couple of examples for you. If you think about the Syrian war, where accountability has been chronically lacking, it is striking to me that making more progress than UN investigations, making more progress than any international commission, it has been civil society groups using the principles of universal jurisdiction who mounted court cases in Germany, supported by the German government, to hold accountable those who were accused of perpetrating war crimes. If you think about where the countervailing power is going to come from, and we're going to talk about this, I think one looks to civil society mobilization more than one looks to governments at the moment, and more than one looks also to the private sector, because I point out in my article in Foreign Affairs that after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi by the Saudi regime, there was a private sector boycott of the so-called Davos in the desert for 1 year. But then by the next year, everyone went back. And that doesn't really send any warning at all. So I think that on the governmental front, it's quite barren. And that's why there's so many hopes vested in the determination of the Biden administration to bring international law back into the center of American foreign policy. And that seems to me to be a really important moment. There's a great danger of overstretch and overreach. And my argument is, by focusing on the rule of law and by focusing on accountability promotion, there's a chance of making progress.
I'm curious, David, you run one of the world's most important nonprofit civil society organizations working in the speech. As you mentioned earlier, people who work for the IRC have been killed while carrying out their duties. They've been victims of impunity. Will the IRC and organizations like it be able to continue working in conflict zones if something isn't done to curtail impunity? And I ask that because certainly Americans who give to organizations like the IRC take pride in the fact that these organizations are making a difference on the ground, and indeed they do. But can they continue to operate if they themselves are going to become targets of governments and terrorist organizations?
We at the International Rescue Committee pride ourselves on going to the places that others don't reach. And we do so by hiring locally. We don't send in Americans or Brits to go beyond the writ of the international system. We hire locally. And so in northwest Syria, where non-state groups are in control, you'll find the IRC. Across Afghanistan in 9 provinces, you'll find the IRC. We're the largest health provider in Rakhine State in Myanmar. And in all those places, we have to work with the consent of the local authorities, be they governments or non-state actors. And what's been remarkable to me over the last 7 years that I've been leading the International Rescue Committee is how much further we're able to go and how our defense doesn't come from guns or even from laws. It comes from the support of our clients, because those who are ruling over the areas where we live and the people who live there, they want to retain the loyalty of the people, or at least the acceptance of the people who are living there. And we find that when we're delivering education services to girls, or when we are extending health facilities to marginalized populations, or when we are trying to support economic livelihoods, it's the confidence and the intelligence, as well as the courage of the local populations, some of whom we recruit to work for us, that allows us actually to say very openly and honestly to our supporters, be they governments or private individuals, that you've got a more extensive network with the IRC today than 20 years ago. And unfortunately, the risks are greater, but those are risks that people will face living there, whether they work for us or not. And by working for us, they can actually make the situation better.
So taking the point that the IRC's work might be easier and less dangerous if the age of impunity came to an end, what do you recommend be done? What should be done and who should do it?
Well, I think we've got to work at this through the right analytical frame, and that is to understand that impunity is the exercise of absolute power, and that if you want to curb impunity, you have to establish accountability. And accountability comes from documenting what happens, reporting what happens, holding accountable those who perpetrate crimes, and then setting precedent that those who do abuse the rights of civilians are held accountable for it, and that others who are thinking of doing the same change their calculus. And it's changing the calculus of military commanders and political leaders that is now the essential tool. And I'm afraid this is going to have to be a multi-year effort across multi-sectors. It's going to take government, it's going to take the private sector, and it's going to take civil society. But I would say that there are more tools at our disposal than we are currently using. Just to take the example of Syria, the failure to establish proper commissions of inquiry into the many dozens of health facilities that have been bombed in the course of the war is in part because of a Russian threatened veto, but it's also because the price for the Russians of threatening that veto has been very low indeed. And there hasn't been much premium put on that issue in the UN Security Council by the US until now, or by others. And so I think the first thing I would say to you is that governments who do want to commit to defending international rule of law have got to do so together using the tools that are at their disposal and are not currently being used. I think I gave you the example of the use of universal jurisdiction. I'd also point to military relationships. Governments, including those in the West, have to get their own houses in order, because the Saudi-led coalition that bombed the coachload of children in northern Yemen had US support and couldn't fly those planes without US support. So job one is in the governmental sector. I do think that the private sector has a very important role. You know this from social change in your own country. It applies as much internationally. That applies to the manufacturers and financiers of weapons. If you don't want your weapons to be used for external aggression or internal repression, then there are obligations in how you live and sell. I think there's a special responsibility too, obviously, on the tech and media companies, who can both be facilitators of hate but they can also be facilitators of reporting, safe reporting by those who are witnesses to abuse. We know that before war crimes, you have media blackouts, and there's an important responsibility there. None of this will happen without civil society getting its voice heard. We've seen the potential of civil society to be an innovator and an influencer through the actions of independent actors like Bellingcat, which has done so much to document some human rights and rule of law abuse that goes on around the world. But as I think back over the last 20 years and the story we're telling, or I'm telling, about the shift towards an age of impunity, civil society's voice hasn't been loud enough, and it needs to be louder.
There's a lot there to dig into, David. Let me just take one slice, and it's the question of the International Criminal Court. As you noted, the United States is not a member of the ICC, and there are a fair number of countries, particularly in Africa, who have been critical of the ICC, seeing it as an organization that is focused on issues in Africa, not elsewhere around the world. To what extent can the ICC play a useful role in addressing these issues, or is it too handicapped both by the lack of U.S. involvement and by the criticism it gets from many countries?
Well, we've seen the potential of international criminal tribunals, like through the work of that on Yugoslavia, which in some ways its development went side by side with the development of the ICC on the basis of the Rome Statute. It's vital that the ICC is able to show that it works without fear or favor, but it obviously faces political attack and it needs to be extremely smart in the way that it works. I was part of a government that joined the International Criminal Court in the late 1990s and then was foreign secretary during a time that we were signatories to the ICC and obviously remain so. And so I think these institutions need to find their feet. It's still a relatively new institution. It needs to show that it has the ability to reach and defend the principles on which it was established. And obviously for countries like the US, there's an obligation to act in accordance with the principles and the rules of transparency, never mind international humanitarian law, in the way that it conducts itself and the way that it conducts investigations and the way that it holds itself to account. I'm not going to join the argument about the politicization of the ICC. What I would plead with people is to recognize the importance of having an institution like that that can be the ultimate judicial guarantor of a rules-based system.
Let's talk a bit about the United States, David. What role does it have to play in this age of impunity? Does the United States have a special role to play? I know that Joe Biden has made much of the fact that America is back. In the case of impunity, is America back?
Well, I think that we can answer that question by looking back as well as looking forward. And if you ask yourself, the attitude of President Trump play an important role in conditioning international engagement with questions of law over the last 4 or 5 years, the 4 years of his presidency? The answer is undoubtedly yes. Through his actions and his words, through the way in which he came to see international law as an encumbrance, not a defense of American values, he gave an extremely strong signal to those around the world who wanted to abuse those laws and disregard them. So there's some evidence about the importance of America from very recent history. In this case, it was evidence for how it can lead or be part of a descent to the bottom rather than a race to the top. Now, the question is, can President Biden reverse that trend? He can certainly reverse that trend within America and within its own ambit. And the commitments that he's made about the way American forces and American diplomats will engage internationally is very important. And getting your own house in order is the first step to encouraging other people to get their houses in order. The second step is obviously to make the most of one of America's unique selling points, which is that it has allies. And those allies are hedging at the moment. They're hedging about where America is going to stand over the next 15 or 20 years. And so I think rebolting America into what's sometimes called the Western Alliance, but of course it's not a geographic alliance, it's a political alliance. I think it was Joschka Fischer, the former German foreign minister, who said that the birth certificate of the Western Alliance was the Atlantic Charter. And it was a political alliance, not just a geographic alliance. But the third step then is obviously to mobilize power in defense of the rule of law. And I made the argument that an accountability promotion agenda can avoid both the dangers and the pitfalls of what was called the democracy promotion agenda under the second President Bush. It was very grandiloquent, but there was a big mismatch between grandiloquence and reality. But it can also avoid the fate of President Obama's agenda to prevent mass atrocities, which was to establish a committee within the US government, but it didn't have traction abroad. I think that the challenge and the opportunity for an accountability promotion agenda is that it really rallies global opinion in a serious way, that it does so across the public, private, voluntary sector, NGO divide, and that it establishes the rule of law rather than the political system as the lodestar for the pursuit of the common good. And that seems to me to be an agenda that could really provide something important for the summit of democracies that President Biden has said he wants to convene. But it could also provide a basis on which countries will look at the United States and the alliances it has with them in a serious way that speaks to their own situation.
David, I want to explore this question of a gap between promise and delivery. And I want to draw on your experience as an actual policymaker. Looking at the Biden administration, it clearly, in the specific case of Yemen, has withdrawn U.S. support, put pressure on the Saudis to end the war. However, the Biden administration didn't go so far as to make Mohammed bin Salman persona non grata, as many people called for. And my guess is it had a lot to do with the fact that the United States has other interests and issues with the government of Saudi Arabia. How should an American administration think about the issue of trade-offs between wanting to defend this very important principle of not allowing impunity, but also recognizing that there are other geopolitical considerations that Washington has to take into account?
I sometimes wonder whether Americans really recognize their own power. I mean, America is such a powerful global economic, political, military actor that the trade-offs for America are much less than the trade-offs for some medium-sized countries that I know very well. And I think that in the Yemen case, America showed it meant business at the beginning. It withdrew support for military operations. It established an experienced diplomat as an envoy. And it now needs the third, fourth, and fifth steps on that road to show that it means business. It needs to account for its own behavior. It needs to account for the behavior of the Saudi-led coalition. And it shouldn't underestimate that when America says it's going to do something and does it, others will have to conform to those standards that it establishes. Because it's true, you're absolutely right. America has a range of equities with countries around the world. But so do other countries have a range of equities with the United States. This plays both ways. And I think that there is room for the Biden administration to do more than square the circle. I think it has the opportunity, if you'll pardon a mixed metaphor, it has an opportunity to reset the table and say, this is how we're going to conduct ourselves. This is what we expect of our partners. And this is the engagement that we want with those who are not yet our partners, but we want them to be. And this isn't about being imperialist or being cocky. It's about saying that when we make commitments in international law, as all countries have done to the UN Charter and its associated instruments, we're going to stick by them. And we're going to stick by them at the southern border when it comes to the treatment of asylum seekers. We're going to stick by them in terms of the international commitments that we make. And we're going to stick to them in the way in which we expect our friends and partners to live. And I think that the list of commitments is small, but it's vital. And if they become undermined, we all lose.
David, I want to close by asking how you would respond to two types of criticisms about having the United States exercise its power more forcefully to end impunity. And like one criticism would come from those people who would say the United States doesn't have the appropriate status to demand others be held accountable when the United States over the years has engaged in practices that led to the killing of civilians, whether you're talking about indiscriminate bombing in Vietnam, we're talking about practices in Afghanistan or Iraq. Second group of people would say, you know what, the United States is in the position it's in today because it went into places like Afghanistan, in Iraq, trying to fix things and make it better. And the United States would be better off if it spent more time working on things at home and didn't try to, in the common phrase, play the role of the world's policeman.
So my argument is not that America should be the world's policeman, nor is it that it should be the world's lawyer. What I believe is that America should recognize its role in the world. And in respect of the second argument, I think I would make the case that America may not want to be engaged with the world, but the world is engaged with America. And its interests, as well as its morals, are challenged by what happens around the world. There's a famous book, which I'm sure you know, by John Eikenbury, about how the rules-based international order was built with a critical role for the democratic states with a very clear goal in mind, to strengthen democracy at home. It wasn't just an idealistic project, it was a realistic project that recognized even after the 1940s that democracy at home depended on, to some extent, on the rule of law abroad, that there was an interdependence even then. And obviously we live today in an age of hyper-connectedness, deep interdependence. And I really worry that what we're seeing on the tip of the iceberg, the abuse of the rights of civilians in war, the abuse of their rights won't stop there. Countries that are willing to abuse human rights will in the end abuse property rights and other rights as well. So I think that the second argument that you hear, or the second criticism, is to recognize that there's no holiday from history. America needs, in its own interests, as well as in the global interest, to concern itself with the global commons. The first argument is about American standing, and that's a very serious argument. But I don't think you need to be perfect in order to work with others to make things better. You just have to have a serious commitment to make yourself better. And if you're learning from your mistakes, showing that you're able to do so, and committed to live by rules that are internationally agreed, you've got something to say and you've got the standing to say it. I come back to this point many times. I'm not asking to invent new rules or new laws to protect civilians. I'm saying we've got to live up to rules, laws, norms that have been established for the last 70 years, but not been observed. And they're being decreasingly observed. And that is a real threat to many things that we should hold dear.
On that sobering note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been David Miliband, President and CEO of the International Rescue Committee. You can read his article on the Age of Impunity at foreignaffairs.com. David, thank you. Really interesting conversation.
Thank you so much, Jim. I really enjoyed it.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Jeremy was also our recording engineer. Thank you, Jeremy. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch and Anna Shortridge for their assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.